debt. It keeps you tossing and turning at night. You can't get away from it. But the truth is, the system is designed to trap you in debt. Insanely high interest credit cards and loans make it nearly impossible to pay off your debt. There's a new way out of the debt trap, Pivotal Debt Solutions. Pivotal Debt Solutions isn't like the old school debt relief companies that string your debt out for years. They have aggressive strategies that can end your debt faster and easier than you thought possible. Pivotal Debt Solutions can cut or even eliminate interest. Find programs to write off your balances so you owe less. Stop those threatening phone calls, and without bankruptcy and without a loan. Bottom line, they find every solution possible to end your debt permanently. Before you do anything, contact Pivotal Debt Solutions first. Talk to them for free. Find out how fast they can help you get out of debt. Visit zapmydebt.com. That's zapmydebt.com. Zapmydebt.com.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
A very special crazy alert for you. This QAnon influencer known as the Queen, seriously, I'm not making this up, is inspiring a wave of harassment, Travis Geddes writes over at drawstory.com, against healthcare providers. Romana DiDullo is, according to this new conspiracy theory out there, is the secret Queen of Canada. That Queen Elizabeth II was executed for crimes against humanity, and that this Romana DiDullo woman is now the actual Queen of Canada and of England, apparently. And she is asking her followers to send form letters to U.S. health clinics and Walmarts accusing them of war crimes related to COVID-19 mitigation. It doesn't get weirder than that. Anyhow, our crazy alert for the day. That said, on the line with us right now is Jay Famlietti. Jay is the executive director and professor at the Global Institute for Water Security at the University of Saskatchewan. JayFamlietti.com is the website. It's spelled JayFamlietti.com. And Jay Famlietti spelled the same way as his Twitter handle as well. Dr. Famlietti, welcome back to the program. It's been a while since we've talked. I saw this story about how the Colorado River is now running out of water, basically, in the American West. They're starting to have to take farms offline and things. Where are we at with regard to this water crisis?
We're in a pretty bad place, Tom. You know, this is a colossal drought. It could go down as the worst drought in history because of its spatial extent. It covers all of Western North America because the temperatures are so hot. And, you know, the water management part becomes very, very tricky under these conditions. Our management is set up for much wetter times. Things are getting much drier. And to complicate matters, we're not doing a great job managing the groundwater, which is our buffer against these droughts, and we're burning through it really quickly. So overall, we're in tough shape.
So how tough? What are the metrics that you're looking at that tell you that this is a crisis? And what do they tell us for the next, you know, few years or longer? I mean, where do we start hitting, you know, mileposts where we know that we've gone way too far?
Well, so there's a couple of things. One thing that we look at carefully is the level of water in Lake Mead, and that's at 1,067 feet above sea level right now, and it's headed for 1,066. And so that's a critical threshold. If that continues to drop, we'll move into more stringent conservation measures. The other thing that we look at is a couple of other things, especially in the West. how wet the winters were. The snowpack is really important for surface water availability, the water in our rivers and our streams and our reservoirs. It's a really terrible winter, especially in California. I've been looking at some of our satellite data. In the 20 years that I've been looking at our satellite data, this is the worst winter, the driest winter in the last 20 years in the satellite record that I've been looking at. And the third thing is the groundwater levels. Again, the groundwater is that water that's underground. We pump it out. It's our buffer against drought, and it really supplements a lot of our water supplies around the West. You know, we are headed towards the lowest point ever. Let's put it that way. In a few more months, or maybe this time next year, we'll be at a lowest point ever.
What do we do about this? We're not changing the weather any day soon, and it looks like this is the new normal. Is it enough for cities just to, you know, recycle their wastewater, like I know some California cities are doing right now? Is it enough for us to figure out ways to do agriculture, to farm that are less water intensive? I know that at least one hydro dam has been shut down out west here, because there just wasn't enough water, you know, a dam producing electricity. What do we do about that, too? Everybody put solar panels on the roofs? I mean, are there solutions here that can be dealt with, or, you know, within the time frame of this going from crisis to disaster?
I think that's the key, Tom, is the speed with which we respond. You know, the IPCC report came out last week showing that, you know, things aren't getting any better, you know, climate's getting hotter, water supply is decreasing around the world. I just drove across Western North America. I drove down from Saskatoon. I'm in San Luis Obispo right now. It was like driving through the apocalypse. I mean, it was literally scorched earth. So, you know, we are at a point where we really have to adapt. We have to, so all the things that you said are important. So with respect to water, we have to keep conserving in our cities. I think the big efficiencies, the big savings will come from agriculture. That's where we use 80% of our water. And so there's a lot of efficiencies that can be realized there. That's going to require new policy across the West. Maybe acceleration of some policy that's already in place here in California, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. But everything else that you said is true. I mean, we have to, anything that we can do to save energy saves water. Anything that we can do to save water saves energy. We have to be looking at, one thing to keep in mind is that water and energy and food are all intimately linked. So any of the savings that we realize in any of those three things individually affects the others. So, you know, thinking about how we can grow food more efficiently using less water will also, you know, save energy. Thinking about how we can save energy will end up saving water and probably end up having some impacts on food security as well.
Are you seeing the Western American states collaborating on this, or are we going to have water wars?
So yeah, that's a two-part answer. And the first part is we're already collaborating on things like in big river basins. So we collaborate in the Colorado River Basin, and we've got the drought contingency plan, and that works well. We've got collaborations going on in the Pacific Northwest and even into Canada. So all that's going well. The problem, I think, is more on the groundwater side. Groundwater is handled state by state, yet some of these big groundwater systems, and it's not just the Western U.S., but it's around the world. They either span state boundaries or international boundaries. That's where the collaborations need to come into play. Another thing we need to think about is if you look at the West and you look at California, California is trying to produce food for like all of North America, but only using California's water. So that's something that needs to be worked out. Either agriculture is going to have to move, or we're going to have to move more water to California. It's a national scale, if not an international scale problem.
Yeah. Wow. Amazing stuff. Dr. Jay Famliati, the executive director and professor at the Global Institute for Water Security at the University of Saskatchewan, jfamlietti.com, FAMIGLIETTI. And Twitter, @JFamilyEddie. Dr. Famliati, thanks a lot for dropping by. It's always great talking to you.
My pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. I really hope we can get this under control. So on Monday, we were reporting in considerable depth about this new IPCC report. Pretty shocking stuff coming out. Wanted to check in with somebody who knows this stuff much better than I do. Distinguished professor of meteorology and the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University, a member of the National Academy of Sciences and recipient of the Tyler Prize, the author of several books, including The Madhouse Effect and most recently The New Climate War, Dr. Michael Mann. MichaelMann.net is the website, and Michael E. Mann, Mann always with two N's at the end, Michael E. Mann is his Twitter handle. And Dr. Mann, welcome back to the program. First, let me start out by apologizing to you. You know, right now in front of God and the world, because last week or the week before I was interviewing Dr. Jason Box, and I made a reference to people who thought that I was exaggerating the severity of the climate crisis back 5, 6, 7 years ago when I was making some videos with some friends. And I used your name, and I immediately thought, oh, my God, I shouldn't have said that, but it was like too late to back it up. And you have never, to the best of my knowledge, told me that I've gone over the edge or, for that matter, tried to minimize the dangers of climate change. So I wanted to apologize to you if that ever made its way back to you. I have no idea if it did or not, but if it did, I apologize. But thank you for being with us today.
It didn't, Tom.
Okay.
No, thanks. It's always great to be with you, my friend.
Thank you. Yeah, it is. It's super having you and having access to a mind like yours. So give us your educated summary of what the IPCC is saying.
Well, the IPCC is coming about as close as you're ever going to see a group of scientists to screaming from the rooftops, because that's essentially what this report is doing. Look, it's been how many years? 30 years since the first IPCC report. And even at that point, we knew that there was a climate threat. 30 years down the road, 3 decades down the road, we still haven't seen the sort of action that's necessary to avert this coming crisis, this crisis that's here and is going only to get worse if we don't act. So they've really connected the dots. What was striking to me, not so much the specifics of the research that's described in this report, because, you know, I already am familiar with it. The report is simply an assessment of existing scientific research. There's no new research. It's summarizing, you know, what we've learned over the last 5 or 6 years since the last IPCC report. But what strikes me with this report is the way that the IPCC has now connected the dots. They are saying, in essence, these unprecedented and catastrophic extreme weather events that you're seeing play out on your television screens this summer as we speak, the second largest wildfire in California history, threatening to become the worst, this would not be happening if not for the warming of the planet caused by human carbon emissions, fossil fuel burning, and other activities that are raising the concentrations of these warming gases in the atmosphere. So they've really connected the dots, and they've also, I think, underscored the importance of taking action. One of the things that they show is that if we bring our carbon emissions down dramatically over the next decade, we can probably keep sea level rise within a manageable range, a few feet by the end of the century. It's going to be obviously a huge challenge to deal with that, but it's within our adaptive capacity. If we fail to act to bring down carbon emissions dramatically within the next decade, then what they're saying is we can't rule out, you know, 10 feet of global sea level rise within a century and a half. We're talking the inundation of major coastal cities around the world. So it's a tale of two possible futures, one where we keep warming within sort of a manageable range, we act dramatically, one where we fail to act, and, you know, we do face a truly catastrophic consequence.
It seems to me that there might even be like three scenarios. One where we radically stop carbonizing our atmosphere and we get these things under control and we slow down the process. Although the IPCC report, from my read of it, indicates that we've gone past several tipping points that it'll take centuries or even millennia to recover from. But that, number one. Number two, that climate change, if we don't do at the very least this stuff, climate change will get so bad that it is disruptive of civilization itself. And I think that we're seeing the leading edges of this in Guatemala right now. You know, we're getting all these refugees in the southern border. Syria, the Syrian refugees after the farmers, you know, their lands turned to desert. They ended up in Damascus. The government, you know, refused to give them food, and you had a semi-revolution there. We saw the same thing in Tunisia. It was the Arab Spring, basically. It was climate change. And it's flipping governments around the world. Well, this will become just an international phenomena. And the collapse of civilization could easily lead to the death of, you know, a large chunk of the human population, at least a billion people, maybe more. And then the third scenario is where it gets so extreme that, you know, it starts approaching, you know, I realize there's a lot of debate about whether it would ever get as bad as the Permian, but maybe the PETM, where it gets so bad that, you know, we're just basically shattered back to a tribal lifestyle if humans even survive. Am I overstating any of that?
Not really. You know, you're talking about a worst case scenario that absolutely is possible if we completely fail to get this problem under control. On the other hand, if we do bring carbon emissions down by 50% within the next decade, down to zero by 2050, then we'll keep the warming of the planet most likely below 1.5 degrees Celsius, 3 degrees Fahrenheit, as the report explains. And that will prevent a lot of the worst impacts, although, as you allude to, some of the changes are now baked in. There may be more than a meter of sea level rise baked in. If we're lucky, if we're fortunate, it takes, you know, a century for that to happen. But the report really does stress the very different consequences of a scenario of near-term dramatic decarbonization and a scenario of inaction, the worst case version of which does resemble sort of a dystopian future where we do see the collapse of civilization. That's a possible future. It doesn't have to be our future, and that's critical. Dramatic action can limit the damage, but we can't prevent the damage because, look, it's already here, as you've alluded to. And we are seeing environmental refugeeism, climate refugeeism. We're seeing it here in the United States, where coastlines are being flooded, where areas are becoming too wildfire-prone. We are going to see migration, climate refugees here within the United States. So this isn't just something that's happening elsewhere around the world. It's going to happen here. And the point is, if we allow the warming to continue, then it makes things that much worse.
Yeah, just talk to the folks who used to live in Paradise, California, or Greenberg.
Right. So, I think so ironically the named.
Yeah, and then both
so ironic. Yeah.
Yeah. So what's your sense? I mean, you're the scientist. I realize you're not a politician, but there are politicians who are trying to work on this. We've got this $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill that goes along with the $1 trillion one. The $1 trillion one has been, you know, watered down to not have really much climate stuff in it because, you know, they had to get Republican votes. And the Republican Party in America still officially does not believe climate change is happening. But the $3.5 trillion bill looks like it's a good start. What are your thoughts on how we're going about trying to deal with this process, at least here in the United States?
Yeah, I think you've got it right there, Tom. The you know, infrastructure package, it has a few things here and there. Resilience, sure, we do need to, you know, take steps to be more resilient in the face of the impacts of climate change. And that's particularly true for, you know, the poorest among us, those with the least resources. So there's some good stuff in there in that regard. Increased networks of charging stations to help the transition to electric vehicles. There's some good infrastructure stuff in there, but there's no sort of major climate action. What we really need is massive spending on renewable energy. We need to prevent new fossil fuel infrastructure. And one of the things that is in the current draft of the reconciliation bill, the $3 trillion reconciliation bill, is something that's known as a clean energy portfolio standard. It's an alternative to, say, carbon pricing, which is out of favor right now politically. It's another way of trying to accelerate the transition away from fossil fuels towards renewable energy by requiring, requiring energy companies, utilities, to generate as much as 80% of
electricity from renewable energy by 2030, consistent with President Biden's commitment to decarbonize the power sector by 2035. And so there are some important things in that reconciliation bill that complement the executive actions we're seeing from the Biden administration that codify this effort to move away from fossil fuels. And you're right, you're not going to get Republicans, modern day, current day Republicans, behind a bill that seeks to decarbonize our economy because they're in the pay of the fossil fuel industry. They continue to be advocates for the fossil fuel industry. So almost certainly this will have to come through a partisan reconciliation bill that does prioritize climate action. And hopefully this latest report provides the wind in the sails for Democrats to make that case to the American people that we need to do this and we need to do it now.
Dr. Mann, we have just 45 seconds before we hit a break I can't control. What's the rest of the world doing?
Well, they're watching us, right? And to the extent that we take leadership, we are starting to see now other players come to the table. China is back in meaningful negotiations. There's a lot of pressure on Australia, which has really been obstinate when it comes to these global climate negotiations. So just the fact that the United States is leading again on the world stage is leading to greater engagement on the part of the other countries. But there's still a lot of work that needs to be done by the time we get to COP26 at the end of this year and actually try to have some global negotiations that will, you know, that will lead us down the path that we need to go now.
When is COP26 will be the, where is that going to be? And that's going to be the last one of these, or the most, that'll be the most recent of these big, what, every 5 year meetings?
Yeah, that's November this year in Glasgow. All eyes are on Glasgow. This is our next best opportunity to get the world on the right path of decarbonization and avert a true climate crisis.
There you go. Dr. Michael Mann, his most recent book, The New Climate War, is really worth getting and reading. Michael Mann, with2ns.net, and Michael E. Mann on Twitter. Dr. Mann, thank you for dropping by. Great talking with you.
Thank you, my friend. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Me too.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Tom Hartman here with you. On the line with us is Jimmy Tobias, an investigative journalist and contributing writer at The Guardian and a contributor to The Nation, The Intercept, and more. His most recent piece was published over at thenation.com, although you can also find his writings at jimmytobias.com. And Jimmy and James C. Tobias is his Twitter handle, and of course, The Nation, at The Nation. Jimmy, welcome to the program. Tell us about the collapse of the red wolves. These are animals that at one time, you know, basically went from eastern Texas all the way up to Indiana, all the way down to the Gulf Coast, all the way over to the East Coast. And now there's this just little teeny tiny range of them along the Gulf Coast and in the upper East Coast, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on the show. The red wolf is a distinct species, smaller than its larger cousin, the gray wolf. And it used to roam, as you said, you know, across the South and much of the eastern seaboard. And by the mid-20th century, it was pretty much wiped out by persecution, poisoning, federal predator control efforts. But then After the Endangered Species Act was passed in 1973, the wolf was listed, and the government, the Fish and Wildlife Service, swooped in and saved the last 14 red wolves from the wild. They pulled them out of the wild, started a captive breeding program, and reintroduced them on the eastern coast of North Carolina at a place called the Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge. And from there, this reintroduction effort grew the population by tenfold. It was an enormous success. But then that program collapsed and the government pulled the plug.
Which government, why, and when?
It was the federal government during the Obama administration that basically stopped the reintroduction effort. And since that time, the wolf population in North Carolina has absolutely plummeted.
Why would they
do that?
And
now there's maybe... Yeah, well, the Fish and Wildlife Service in recent decades has really been struggling to uphold the Endangered Species Act. It sort of often bends to powerful political interests. And in this case, there were some large, wealthy landowners, farmers, and you know, North Carolina Republicans who just came after this program and wanted it to disappear. And the government basically folded to that pressure.
What's the population now? It went from 14 to 140, and now it's back down to what?
Yeah, some say 7, some say 9, some say, you know, maybe there's 20 wild wolves still on the landscape.
Wow.
So, you know, it's kind of back where it started after decades and millions of dollars of efforts to save this species.
Now, I know Ted Nugent came, you were writing about this in your piece over at The Nation, about how Ted Nugent was like, you know, let's kill the wolves and all this kind of stuff. And it's become like an article of faith on the hard right to be macho by killing top predators. You know, you've got the Trump children going over to Africa and the Himalayas killing, you know, large animals. Do these wolves represent a threat to agriculture? I thought most, you know, animal farming these days, for lack of a better phrase, was done as factory farms rather than grange fed. And even at that, I mean, do they represent a threat, or is this just, you know, Yahoo's wanting to shoot something that's cool?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, wolves and a lot of large predators have sort of become this culture war figure, and there's this fight over reintroduction efforts and species protection efforts all over the country. I think many on the right and many large industry groups see any kind of species protection as sometimes a form of like government tyranny or overreach, and so people really go after these programs. And you know, of course, there are the occasional, you know, livestock, I'm sure, that's lost by, you know, lost to wolves or other large predators. That certainly happens, but it's something more than that. I think there's sort of this it's almost become like a culture war across the country. I mean, it's not just in North Carolina, it's in the West, where wolves right now are being wolf programs are being attacked, you know, ruthlessly by Republican legislatures. But really, in general, the Endangered Species Act is loathed by big industry groups and people on the right, and they'd love to see it disappear. And too often, the federal government, the agency responsible with enforcing it, the Fish and Wildlife Service, sort of bends to the pressures from these groups.
Is the Fish and Wildlife Service institutionally genuinely in favor of preserving endangered species that fall under their purview, or you know, sort of like the Border Patrol, are they only reluctantly going along with anything that doesn't comport with Republican politics?
Well, I mean, I have enormous respect for the Fish and Wildlife Service. It has done so much to protect and preserve the species of this country. But, and there are so many great people at the agency, but there has been, a culture has taken root, I think, at the top levels of this agency, where people at the top are sort of apologetic for the mission that the agency is supposed to pursue. And there's sort of a weakness among the top leadership sometimes that you can see. And I think, you know, and this is not a partisan problem. I mean, the Fish and Wildlife Service has been struggling through both Democrat and Republican administrations for some time now.
So it's not a matter of, like, you know, with the post office, Trump installs some toady to go in there and wreak havoc like Louis DeJoy, and now, you know, the Biden administration's having trouble extracting them. This is far deeper, more systemic, and more long-term.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. And I think, you know, you talk to many retired Fish and Wildlife Service people, and they'd really like to see, you know, cultural change, reform at the agency, especially in this era where we're facing a growing global extinction crisis. We really need a strong Fish and Wildlife Service and a strong ESA if we're going to protect, you know, the many, many imperiled species across this country.
So, Jimmy Tobias, for people who are listening to this conversation and would like to be proactive, would like to do something, would like to, you know, even make a phone call, what do we do?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the most important thing to know is that the Endangered Species Act has enormous support among the American public. I mean, it's something like 80% of the public supports this law. I mean, that's more than Congress, the courts, almost anything I can think of. Mm-hmm. And so the people support it, but it's at the, you know, bureaucratic level, it's in the halls of power where this law is sort of being betrayed. And so I think if Americans make their voices heard about the species in their own backyards, about the species that they love, then a change could be made moving forward.
Yeah. So speak up to your elected officials. You know, get the word out there. Jimmy Tobias, JimmyTobias.com, TheNation.com for this brilliant piece, warning the collapse of the red wolves should worry us over at The Nation. Jimmy, thank you. Thanks for the great work you're doing and for dropping by the program.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Johan in Los Angeles. Hey, Johan, what's on your mind today?
I want to talk about the climate change and the new transportation or the alternative transportation.
Mm-hmm. Go for it.
Have you heard the maglev?
Maglev, yes. Magnetic levitation, yes.
Yeah.
That's the kind of trains they have in Japan and China.
Yes, it is. Maximum is like 603 kilometers per hour. Do you think that will happen here under Biden administration?
We'll see. I don't know if maglev specifically is part of the $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill, but they're talking about, you know, dramatically increasing our rail network. It's so much.
Yeah, because they we have a new rail bright line,
mm-hmm.
and of course the U.S. government, the Amtrak.
Yeah,
I think we need all of those. And then I saw the one video that maglev can replace airplanes.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're using it for mass transportation. It's just a way of reducing friction. You know, friction is the big thing that you fight when you're trying to move, when you're trying to transport anything, you know. And there's a certain amount of friction with wheels on pavement. There's a certain amount of friction with rail, you know, wheels on rail. And if you can lift the car itself a 16th of an inch off the track by using a sufficiently strong magnetic force to basically levitate the car, then the only friction you're going to encounter is that very, very thin layer of air that's there. And then you're approaching, you know, efficiencies like you see with airplanes. It's the reason why, you know, an airplane going coast to coast is burning a fraction of the fossil fuel that you would have if you drove from coast to coast. And the same thing with maglev. So whether we're going to get that specifically or whether that's going to be a piece of this, to the best of my knowledge, is not specified, but it's one of a number of great technologies out there. They're also making trains more aerodynamic, which is why they look so sleek, you know, and like that. And, you know, they're developing new ways, new kinds of bearing technologies, like the ball bearings, you know, and new lubricants and things inside them. And of course, the electric motors. I mean, this is something that the rail industry figured out 50 years ago, was that electric motors were more efficient than gas or diesel power motors. So all of your engines, your rail engines all across the United States are basically like hybrids. You have 100% electric motors running the cars, and then you generate the electricity for those electric motors with a diesel generating plant located in the engine, and you know, taking that electricity and from another source instead of pulling it off, you know, a diesel generator in the car, but taking it right out of the rail or taking it from a wire above, and then generating that electricity with a central power station that is, you know, a huge wind farm or a huge solar farm, or even, you know, millions of homes that are plugged into the grid. All ways of bringing this about. There are so many ways to achieve this goal. We really need to be looking at 21st century technology rather than this old 19th century stuff, you know, burning fossil fuels. It's just crazy. Johan, thank you very much for the call. We've got a lot on the table. Tim in Hendersonville, North Carolina. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind today?
Well, I just wanted to bring up the idea that war is intrinsically terrible for humans, of course. But what about the flora and fauna? You know, my father-in-law was CIA for 35 years. He told me that basically the carpet bombing and napalm of Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam pretty much wiped out the Asian elephants and the small Asian rhino population that existed at that time. 20 years of bombing in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Iran, there's endangered species that were endangered before, but now, I mean, you know, we never hear about the devastation. I'm an animal wildlife rehabber, and you never hear about the devastation. Old growth forests, you know, the deforestation, wiping all of these things out, it just absolutely is appalling to me. The human cost is tragic. It's terrible. You know, Europeans came here and wiped out 40 million buffalo to kill the Native Americans to get them out of the area. And guess what? We planted grass and all the other junk that, I mean, lamb and everything else that Europeans seem to.
Yeah, we terraformed North America, and you know, civilized people and I put that in scare quotes around the world have been doing this for a long, long time and changing ecosystems. But war is particularly destructive. Tim, you make a great point, and I appreciate your calling and making it. Thank you. Bill in Sandusfield, Maine, Massachusetts. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind today?
Well, I called in before about the climate change being sequestering carbon in the soil to get the carbon down, but actually, I don't know if I mentioned the water cycle, and since it's been a few months, I'll
go for
just mention this again. It hasn't gotten into the science that goes into the reports and so forth. It seems like it's going to take a while for that to get in because they just keep rehashing the same information. So what's going on is that Walter Jana and Jana from JEHNE from Australia and others have looked at the science, and number one, hot surfaces re-radiate more than cold surfaces, and that infrared radiation gets stuck in the atmosphere. So that's part of the warming. Same with bare soil. So when you have soil that's covered, you reduce that radiation.
Right.
Number two, soil that's covered with plants emit a bacteria that is what condenses the rain. That's what helps the Amazon and other parts of forests all over the world condense rain, is that they actually put a bacteria that nucleate ice on them, and when that condensation happens at high altitude, heat is released anytime you condense water, but that heat is released at a higher level, so less atmosphere to absorb it, more of it goes up, less of it.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Thank you, Bill.
It's just the balance of radiation balance.
Right.
Number three, the cooling effect of the rain and of the plants. I guess I already talked about that. The plants and the rain have a cooling effect. The clouds have some cooling effect. Hazes, on the other hand, which is uncondensed water, that is water vapor that is tiny droplets, you know, the kind that spread COVID, the really tiny ones that make the haze, that actually causes warming because the radiation can't escape up through it. But clouds do reflect some light back into space. So when you have more haze, clouds, like haze you think about, the Middle East, the Gulf region, there are a lot of hazes there and high temperatures. They're causing global warming. Not they, but I mean that phenomenon is causing it. So we need to get more clouds, more rain, and less haze, that water in those two forms, larger droplets in clouds and even larger droplets that fall to Earth as rain. That's what's going to help reverse the climate. And the beauty is that the answer is still getting carbon in the soil. It's still restoring the carbon sponge. These additional effects are what I didn't talk about last time.
Brilliant.
And anyway, Walter Jana, J-E-H-N-E, and I don't remember the other scientist. I wrote something up a few years ago and with his name in it, and I forget it because I've heard Walter a bunch of times.
No, it's all good. Bill, thank you for that. Thank you for our moment of geeky science for the day. That was great. That was brilliant. Kathy in Seattle. Hey, Kathy, thanks for listening to KBCS. What's on your mind today?
Oh, hey, I want to talk about the water situation. But before I say that, I want to say that I haven't heard anything about the Trump issue with him pulling out of Syria and leaving all the Kurds in the situation that he did. And I understand that this is more people and this is a bigger issue here in Afghanistan. But all of that stuff with that the Kurds and the Trump is swept aside.
Yeah, that completely slid down the memory hole, didn't it?
Right, and maybe we need to start bringing that back up.
Yeah.
The other thing I really want to talk about with the water situation is that we are growing all kind of food for the rest of the world that doesn't support us, and I think it's time for us to pull our horns in about that.
Are you talking about all the soybeans we're shipping to China?
Well, that's one thing, but in particular what I'm talking about is all the animals. Like Smithfield Farms and stuff like that, that the Chinese own over here on our soil. And they can dictate, they're going to be able to dictate later on who gets food if it comes down to that. And in the meantime, they're using our resources, our water resources for animals that are being shipped over there. And as a side note, a lot of them are slaughtered over here, so we get all the negative effects of all the pollution with the animals and all of that, you know. But the other thing is that we don't have any protection for animals that leave our soil. When they go over to foreign soil, they're left, you know, they treat them horribly over there. They're treated horribly on the ships that they're shipped on over there. And
do we export live animals? I didn't know that. I thought we only exported processed animals.
No, we do. And, you know, that's not right. We've fought hard for animal rights here in the United States. And then to just throw that all up to a foreign country and say, oh, now you can do whatever you want, like the chicken slaughterhouses and all of that stuff. Yeah. Anyways, I won't go on, but those are my points. So appreciate your program.
Well, thank you, Kathy. And I think we need to remember that, you know, in a pound of beef, there's I don't remember the exact numbers now. It was in one of my books years ago. I think it's in The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. But there's something like hundreds of gallons of water to make 1 pound of beef. I forget the number of acres, but it's an enormous amount of natural resources goes into that. And
absolutely.
And we never talk about it. You know, it's like it just kind of, you know, it vanishes. Kathy, thank you very much for the call. Kevin in Long Beach, California. Hey, Kevin, thanks for listening to us on Sirius XM. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, real quick, this is like the second time I called you, and the first time I called you was talking about we missed Ted Kennedy in the Senate because he's a lion and nobody's replaced him. So I think we need somebody like that today. But going forward, you mentioned about using the word killing, and you kind of rephrased it after that, but I think you're right on. You got to say the word killing out there. This is what they're doing. They know what they're doing. He graduated from Harvard and went to Yale Law School. He
Ron
knows
DeSantis.
What he's doing.
Yeah, he's no idiot.
Yeah, right. And so, if we need to use the word fascism, because that's what's taking place.
Well, this goes beyond fascism. Violating public health policies, letting people die as a matter of policy. That's, you know, in a much larger way, that's what Joe Stalin did when he allowed a famine that killed, 13 or 20 million Russians back, you know, in the 40s or the early 50s. This is just a matter of scale. And but it's the same thing. It's allowing people to die as a matter of public policy. And who are the people who are dying, by the way? Who are the most likely people to be vaccinated in Texas and Florida? Upper middle class white people. So who's dying? Lower middle class and lower working class, mostly black and Hispanic people. And I think that, Greg Abbott and Ron DeSantis are looking at that going, hey, this is good.
Well, I agree with that to a point, but I think now it's kids. And I think that's going to be the thing that really will take them down.
The thing I predict. That we are going to find out that the way that this virus, now I could, you know, this is just speculation, right? And I'm no scientist, but just speculation. The old virus accessed the angiotensin receptor sites on the cells. Angiotensin is a hormone that the body produces that regulates blood pressure. It's why when people get to be my age, they end up on angiotensin, ACE inhibitors and angiotensin blockers, ARBs, drugs. Mm-hmm. And as you get older, you get more and more of these angiotensin receptor sites, and or your body becomes more sensitive to it or something. I can't explain the mechanism. I don't understand it that well, but I know it has to do with that hormone. And I'm wondering if this disease doesn't, you know, used to be it couldn't infect, and we had Dr. Eric Feigelding talking about this a week or three ago, it couldn't infect mice and rats, and it couldn't infect deer, presumably because they don't use angiotensin as the way of moderating their, modulating their blood pressure. And again, I may be speaking complete gibberish here, please. But something is going on that's different with this Delta variant, whether it's got a different way of getting into the cell and it doesn't require the angiotensin receptor sites, or whether it's much more efficient at getting into even marginal angiotensin receptor sites, or there's a combination of the three. We're now seeing it hit younger people, and we're now seeing it hit children. And I don't think that some of these Republican governors yet, it has fully sunk into them that it's not just the boomer remover. It's not just old people dying that, you know, they could put up with. I mean, you had, Dan Patrick, I think the lieutenant governor of Texas, saying, I'm over 70. We should just, you know, be willing to lay down our lives for the economy. That was, you know, back during Trump. I don't think that dynamic is at work anymore. I think things have changed, whether it's, you know, whatever the biology of it is. I shouldn't speculate on the air about biology, but anyhow, we'll see.
It's happening, so we'll see, and these guys need to be stopped some way, shape, or form.
Yeah,
so
I'm with you.
I think that using the word killing is apropos.
It's a very specific meaning, and I'm not quite there yet, but I'm close. Kevin, thank you for the call. Jeff in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind?
Hey, good morning, Tom. Hope you're staying cool through our latest brutal heat wave.
Our building's HAC died, and so they brought a room unit in for us. You know, thank God.
Yeah,
it was getting hot.
Yeah, I know. I know what you went through last time.
Today.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Tom, let me ask: What's the big deal for Red State America about having to wear a mask? Is it vanity or stupidity or both? You know, pre-vaccines, places like Taiwan, Hong Kong, South Korea, et cetera, they hardly had any deaths because they all wore masks. At the same time here, Donald Trump facilitated the unnecessary deaths of over 400,000 Americans by actively discouraging mask wearing. And I don't know if you saw it, Tom, but there's this TikTok video from, it's Speak the Truth 101. It's gone viral. It's from this guy whose wife has breast cancer, and he believes she was prematurely discharged from the hospital because all the COVID patients coming in. And this guy's message to the unvaccinated is, hey, if you don't believe in science and medicine to the point where you won't get a life-saving vaccine, then why are you showing up at the hospital and taking beds from people like my wife? And you know, Tom, you look at these people in Tennessee terrorizing these health professionals about mask wearing in schools, and yet these same nasty ignoramuses, they're going to be showing up in the hospital expecting these same health professionals to treat them and save their lives when they get COVID.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, just like that article you pointed out yesterday from the Susan Demis, I believe, mm-hmm. in the Michigan Advance, isn't it time for us to stop coddling this kind of letting ignorance reign supreme in America?
Yeah, I mean, the debate, and I get this, and I, you know, I saw the nurse that was on Rachel's show last night talking about how, you know, it's just absolutely overwhelming dealing with these people who said that they didn't believe in science when it was the vaccine, but now that they're really sick, they want science to save their lives. Please, please, please. Are they villains or are they victims? You know, are they victims of Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity and Fox so-called News and Donald Trump and the people who are lying to them? Or are they the villains? And I'm inclined to think that they're more. Most of them are more victim than villains. Some friends of people that we sort of knew. Our son knew them really, really well. The woman was helped him buy a house. She was a real estate agent. She and her husband both were, you know, big Fox watchers, and they ended up getting COVID and dying. They were good people. They just were, you know, they were getting their information from friggin' liars.
And of course, I leave all the children out of that, out of everything I said. You know, yeah. I mean, obviously they're innocent. But, you know, when they're going on the attack against public health officials, against teachers, against, you know, governors, I mean, you know.
Well, I don't think those were parents in that video last night from Tennessee. I think those were
they were
generic Nazis.
Boards. Well, yeah.
And I think the thing was organized on Facebook, and I think Facebook needs to get some control over that. Ron in San Francisco. Hey, Ron, what's on your mind today?
Been focusing on all this, the economy and the relationship of the economy to the COVID situation and then the fires we have in California. I had been working with and updating with these kids at the student project OpenBeyond.org, and they're talking about going back to school and wearing these masks for COVID. What about the masks for the particulate in the wildfires that get into your, you know, your lungs and
is that starting to hit you there in San Francisco?
I'm now up in Hamilton Field, which is north of San Francisco in Novato area.
Uh-huh.
And we got heavy smoke here.
Oh my!
And
that's brutal stuff. We had that last year here in Portland, and it took me a month before my throat was no longer sore. And that stuff is bad. I mean, it's just not good at all. So, yeah, you want to wear a mask, you know, when the smoke is around. The kind of good news is that KN95 masks, which are the most effective ways to keep that particulate matter out of your lungs, are now ubiquitous. They're everywhere. You can buy them at 7-Eleven, which was very much not the case a year ago.
Let's get them to the kids. Let's get them to the kids.
Yeah.
You're sending to school. You're putting the mask on for COVID. They're useless for the particulate, fine particulate in the wildfire smoke, the toxic substances that get into you and affect your immune system. Let's get a campaign. If you're going to have kids wear masks, have them wear these N95 masks when they're going to and from school, because that atmosphere, if you're in a smoke atmosphere, that could permanently affect your immune system.
Ron. You know, absolutely. And you know, make those masks available, mail them out to people, do whatever's necessary. Ron, thank you. Larry in Los Angeles. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind today?
Hi. Just one quick point on Afghanistan. Donald Trump also stabbed a Kurds in the back. So he's got a record of doing that sort of thing.
Yeah, and he did that in Syria, terribly.
Every chance you can. Yeah, but on deficits, as you'll recall, Bill Clinton never cut spending when he was president. He balanced the budget, had 3 years of balanced budget. And the only time those balanced budgets disappeared is when George W. Bush lowered taxes for the rich that was supposed to stimulate the economy, and we got a recession out of it.
Yeah, you're right, because Clinton raised taxes, and it boosted the economy.
Right. And every Republican who was in Washington voted against that tax increase.
Yep.
And it took Al Gore, because a few Democrats voted against it also. It took Al Gore to come in and break the tie.
Yeah, you're right. I remember. Thank you for the reminder, Larry. You're always so on top of these economic issues. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, but the he left one thing out, your guest, when he was talking. That was QE.
Quantitative easing.
That's enough. Quantitative easing. That's another way that, and I consider it an evil way that the government puts money into circulation, because it's designed to only help corporations.
And this is, you mean the buying corporate bonds part of QE? Because there's also a buying governments part of QE, bond part of QE, which is just the old-fashioned way of doing it.
But that's, you're buying them mostly from rich people and corporations also.
Yeah.
And so there's a way that they could do it. They could actually buy into people's mortgages, use quantitative easing to do that, and that would help most of the American people. And the banks and the corporations will still end up getting all the money.
Yeah, and let people refinance a deal of 1%. Although that may have the effect of really altering home prices around the country. But it's worth thinking about. Larry, thank you. Thank you for the call. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. It's accessible from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/Hartman with two N's. netsuite.com/Hartman. That's netsuite.com/Hartman.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Mike in Millbridge, Maine. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I want to speak about the massive right-wing propaganda and disinformation network. It's driving me crazy because everybody is talking about Fox News and Hannity and people like that, feeling their propaganda as if it's their idea, as if it's coming from them. People truly believe it's actually coming from the corporations and the billionaires, and these people get their walking orders every day, because basically the Republican Party has not done anything for the people in decades. So they have
since
nothing to run on. Since the 50s. So in the early 2000s, that's when they created this massive propaganda, disinformation, fear factory.
Actually, they started building it after the Powell Memo in 71. Within 10 years, you had a dozen major right-wing think tanks. You had a group that would vet lawyers for judgeships. You had, within 15 years of that, you had the creation of Fox News. You had right-wing radio networks. You had the rise of Limbaugh and all his imitators. All that stuff arguably came out of the Powell Memo in 71 and happened over the next 15 years.
Regarding what's currently going on with COVID-19, Republican governors telling their people that masks don't work and vaccines are just scams. And this started, basically, I think, pushback from when Joe Biden became president. And he,
Mike, make no mistake about this. This is a Republican-driven effort to sabotage the economy by creating widespread sickness in the United States and in our schools, by the way. Now they're trying, you know, in Texas and Florida and a few other states, they're trying to get kids, turn these children into basically little bombs, weapons of mass destruction, disease vectors. It contaminate the kids, expose the kids go home, the family gets sick, dad can and mom can no longer go to work, the economy starts to fall apart, Biden has to impose another lockdown on the economy, and there's an election coming in just, you know, a year and a few months, and everybody knows what happens when the economy goes in the crapper. You end up with a change of administration. And, you know, whichever party is in charge, and you've got the Democrats in the White House and the House and the Senate, and if the economy goes to hell, which is what these guys are trying to make happen, then they're going to blame Biden.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm agreeing with you.
That's what I was getting at.
Yeah. I think it goes beyond that, though. I think that they're not just trying to make Biden's efforts to contain the coronavirus seem ineffective in a vacuum. I think that they're also thinking or hoping that his efforts to contain the coronavirus will crash the economy. And the thing that tells me that is that half of the time when they're ranting about this, they include rants about the economy. Right. Something I wanted to flag to you, particularly those of you living in California, Oregon, and Washington State here in the Pacific Northwest. You know how horror movies always start with, you know, some little thing that's like, you know, hey, they just found Ralph dead by the pool. What's going on? You know, or what are these pods in my backyard? And so you just, you know, there's always some little clue, right? And I read this story that FFR posted over on Democratic Underground today, the headline, family of three and their dog found dead about a mile from their vehicle while out day hiking. And I'm like, what? And you read the article and it's like there were no signs of trauma. There's no obvious cause of death. There's no suicide note. They were in the middle of the national forest on a day hike, just a mile from their car. And their dog was dead too, and no signs of trauma. And I'm looking at this, and they're not speculating about this in the articles. I mean, everybody is like scratching their heads, what's going on? But what popped into my mind, and I hope I'm wrong on this, and you know, I'm not saying freak out about this, but I do think we need to keep an eye on it, and I would love to hear from the California officials. that sometimes what precedes tectonic activity, earthquakes, sometimes what precedes them is little cracks in the ground that gases come out from, and you find people being overwhelmed by those gases and dying. And so I hope that they nail this down quickly, because I live, you know, I mean, we live here in Portland, and we're on, you know, part of that giant fault line. The whole Ring of Fire thing goes up through Alaska. And, you know, and our house, I know, was built long before there were earthquake standards. So I'm looking at this going, I am not happy about that. One other thing I wanted to just, you know, flag and put on your consciousness dashboard, as it were. There's some really great news, and this has to do with fewer children ending up brain damaged as a result of simply eating food in our food supply. During the Obama administration, the Environmental Protection Agency made the decision to ban this extraordinarily powerful pesticide. I think it's called chlorpyrifos. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that that's it. First of all, it was whacking farm workers. Pregnant women were giving birth to children that were severely mentally damaged. It was spreading across America, you know, in our food supply, and we were feeding it to our children. And so the Obama administration said, we're going to ban this stuff. They made the decision in 2015. The EPA, under President Obama, this is from today's Washington Post, responded by proposing to prohibit the pesticide. But Scott Pruitt, Donald Trump's EPA administrator, said, no, we're going to reverse that. Pesticide industry, hey, they're big donors to the Republican Party and have been forever. You know, this goes back to 92 when Bill Clinton decided that the Democratic Party was going to take money from clean industries like banks and insurance companies and health insurance companies, and we'll let the dirty industries like the pesticide manufacturers contribute to the Republicans. So Scott Pruitt reversed that and said, oh, no, you can spread this poison on our food supply all you want. And that's been going on for, you know, a couple of decades now. This first popped up in the late 90s. The Clinton administration looked at it and said, well, we need to do some serious studying on this. This does not look good at all. And they began the process. The Bush administration put it on hold for 8 years while we continued to poison our children. And then the Obama administration came in and said, no, let's ban it. And they started the process to ban it in 2015. It just never quite happened, I guess. But now the Biden administration has said enough. The EPA will ban the use of the pesticide. Final rule was released yesterday, and it'll put a stop to the spraying of chlorpyrifos on fruits and vegetables across the country. About time. Good on them.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.